So this is an interesting topic, the interplay of psychology and spirituality. It's one of these that might be a little bit like talking about oxygen in the air or something. I think it's probably something that we're all doing quite well, integrating the psychological and the spiritual. But maybe not. It might be really juicy. We'll see. This was really big in the 80s, this whole topic of how to fit spirituality and psychology together. And this was never really an issue in the East so much, but somehow in the West, when Buddhism and this contemplative practice came to the West, from an Eastern approach, you sort of approach everything through the ultimate lens of, you know, it's all illusory, it's all fleeting, and don't worry about it so much. I mean, even now, if you talk to, like, one of my Tibetan teachers, that's kind of his refrain to me. You know, no problem, don't worry. And somehow our Western lives, in being very complicated and busy, and we do worry a lot, and there is a lot of stress, and there's a way in which Asian teachings, though this is probably changing as Asian cultures get more modernized, but they don't directly address some of the issues and challenges that we as Westerners face. And what also started to become apparent as people were doing long retreat is that there's this process of the path that just by being present with our experience as it is without interference, we're essentially eroding our defenses against our experience, our psychological defenses. So all of our strategies like denying, rationalizing, analyzing, judging, getting scared of our mind. I mean, all of these things are a way of, in a way, defending against our experience. And especially on longer retreats, this practice just erodes all that. You become more and more open, less and less reactive about your experience, more and more just connecting with it as it unfolds. And so this can, for people, drop them into trauma memories or just childhood memories, not at the level of trauma, but difficult childhood issues coming up. And it's very common that people are dealing with some kind of psychological processing through their practice. And there's a way in which practice actually coughs it up in order for it to be purified, ultimately. Up and out is the process. But there's a lot of stuff that can come up that we don't just necessarily let keep going and go out. It troubles us, and we have a lot of emotional difficulties that can come up through our practice. And so it's become more and more apparent that for our Western minds, we need not just spiritual approaches to our psyche, but that we also really need some psychological wisdom around working with some of our particular Western challenges. So Western Buddhism, there's sort of this joke about Zen students tend to be carpenters, Tibetan students of Tibetan Buddhism tend to be artists and creative types, and Vipassana people tend to be psychotherapists. There's something about this tradition, the Vipassana tradition, that we open very much to whatever's happening in the moment. Generally, our practice is not just focused on the breath, it's focused on the body or just choiceless awareness in our full experience. I don't know why this is, but there's something about the Vipassana tradition where it becomes a very psychological kind of inner reckoning on this path. To, you know, there's not a lot of cushion or comforts or other practices. We're just practicing kind of naked awareness and confronting our naked psyches in a sense. And so there's a way in which in the Vipassana world, there's a lot of people getting very savvy about how to integrate psychological and spiritual approaches as we work with our minds. So when we say spirituality and psychology, what does that even mean? So care to just take a stab at what spirituality is and what psychology is? Okay, spirituality is the heart, and psychology is the mind. So that's one. Let's just keep going. Let's just get a bunch of them out on the table.
Spirituality can be something bigger, like connecting with something larger than just yourself.
Okay, so.
Whereas psychology seems to me to be thinking more about yourself.
Okay. So I'm just repeating all these so they make it onto the mic. So spirituality is concerned with something larger than oneself. Psychology is focused on issues related to oneself, is a summary.
Yeah, I was going to say that in a different way, that that spirituality was trying to make sense of the bigger, the greater, and psychology was trying to make sense of the self.
Okay. So spirituality making sense of the greater, spirituality making sense of the self. Psychology, thank you. Kerplunk, okay, that's about it. Okay. I don't know, actually. My meditation bell went off. Goes off every 15 minutes, so just a little reminder. I mean, you could take all of these definitions and in a way apply them to either. That spirituality can also be very mind-oriented, and psychology can be very heart-oriented. Psychology, as it's changed, has become more broad to include spiritual aspects. And Buddhism, in particular, as a spirituality, is a very strong psychology. Psyche. Ology as an exploration of the psyche, of the mind. It's psychological in the sense that you're working with your mind and liberating your mind and understanding your mind through witnessing it, being with it. And doing that psychological process leads to, something greater. So in some ways in Buddhism, we study the self, we go in to realize there is no self. Our separation from things creates the illusion that we're a self. But when we actually really go into the self to find the self, we don't find it. We realize we're everything. We might be a unique and distinct filter of everything, but we are still deeply part of everything. And so that's a very spiritual self-exploration. So the point is, it's very hard to distinguish what we even mean. So I want to define a little bit for the purpose of our discussion. And I want to just outline very briefly the four basic currents in psychology, because even to talk about psychology is to talk about a vast discipline. And whereas say in the 60s there was maybe 20 approaches to psychotherapy. Now there's something like 400. I mean, there's just, and every time Dick and Harry and Jane and Sue and Ellen, you know, have their own really interesting, cool approaches. It's a vast world. So I just saw, you know, I was Googling something today and I saw shamanic psychotherapy, you know. So there's all kinds of psychotherapy, and these two worlds have come together very strongly. But the basic strains in the psychology world are the behavioral, and that our suffering comes from conditioning, so we recondition in order to end our suffering. And this is the kind of the very earliest psychology, and it focuses basically on you know, who you are is your behavior. And there's a lot of truth in that, and it also certainly has its limits. There's a lot more than going on besides your behavior in your mind. That's only focused on the actions, and there's a lot going on mentally that doesn't have to translate into behavior at all. So the next major wave to come along was psychoanalytic or psychodynamic through Freud and many others. And this is taking psychology out of the behavior and into the hidden realms of the mind, the unconscious, and our stored memory and our stored wiring, really, from childhood. So this is a whole, like, developmental strain of psychology that's tracing our current patterns and especially our current woundedness back to childhood deficits. And the therapy here is to go back and have a happy childhood. So as the bumper sticker used to say, you don't see these anymore, but it's never too late to have a happy childhood. By going back and meeting the unmet developmental needs, we actually transform ourselves very deeply by going back and giving ourselves, through therapy, what we didn't get. Another whole strain is the humanistic, and this is emphasizing psychodynamic is very problem-focused, and the humanistic is really emphasizing not just our problems but our deeper potential and for integrating and self-actualizing in a way that feels very authentic and deep and powerful to us. And then the fourth strain is the transpersonal. And this is fairly new. It started with Carl Jung, probably, is one of the people, and there's many others. So it's been around for a long time, but it's becoming very common much more recently. And the transpersonal is going beyond the personal, but through the personal, or across the personal, to go to something bigger. And it's integrating our personal journey with a spiritual connection. And in this approach, our suffering is not just from our childhood or not just from our behaviors that are unskillful, but from a deep spiritual thirst that isn't being met. And even though we can solve some of our psychodynamic problems, there's still going to be this spiritual thirst that needs to be watered for us to really be truly happy. And both humanistic and transpersonal are not as problem-focused. Psychology has often been very problem-focused. And these are psychologies that emphasize not just problems, but the potentials of the human mind, our strengths, our resources, what's working in our lives, and also, as all spiritual paths do, opening us to deep union and transcendent happiness, you could say, by dropping the separation of self and world. So this is a seamless kind of psychology, the transpersonal. There really, ultimately, isn't a distinction between the psychological and the spiritual. That our deepest psychological yearnings when we really get down to it, our spiritual yearnings. We are longing. The way we can most belong, we're longing to belong, and that seems personal. But we can have it even better when we transcend by going through the personal and belong to all of creation. And this is the most profound psychological happiness we can feel. So it all mixes together, psychology and spirituality. But there are some distinctions. I think a crucial distinction we can make is by looking at the goals. So what's psychology for, and what's spirituality for? Psychology tends to be for healing, fixing something, making something better in your experience, in your mind. So either fixing a life problem or fixing some kind of emotional problem or mood challenge in your psyche. Fixing something, healing something. And that's not the goal of spirituality. Spirituality, the goal is liberation, freedom. It's not about fixing. It's about changing our relationship to. So psychology fixes the content in some way. And in spirituality, and I'm speaking very specifically, the Buddhist approach, instead of changing the content, we change our relationship to the content. And that's a big difference. So if you're working with a depressed mood in a kind of classical psychotherapy mode, you're trying to figure out some way to not be depressed. In a Vipassana approach to depression, no need to change it at all. The moment we wake up and are curious about what the experience of depression is like, we've instantly changed our relationship to depression. We're not the depression, because there's the witnessing of the depression. And there's a way in which, by being, now this is a fiction too, but it's kind of an intermediate step, we can sort of identify with the awareness more and be the awareness of the depression. That in and of itself is the opposite. It's aliveness. Depression is a kind of deadness. Being curious and aware of depression is the opposite. It's aliveness. So from a strictly spiritual Vipassana approach, we don't do anything to change it. We just are with it. And the witnessing does, you know, our transforming. Whereas the psychological approach is going to be more about doing something so that the depression lifts. So the simplest distinction is, coming back now, is the difference in the goals. And there's a famous quote by Freud, and this is just a paraphrase, but the job of psychology is to relieve people of their neurotic suffering and leave them with ordinary human unhappiness. And apparently, now I haven't read the actual passage that this was in, but apparently this was a very astute comment, that in a sense he was really pointing to the Buddhist noble truth. It wasn't that comment sounds kind of limited, like that's all therapy's going to do. It's a lot to transform us from out of our neurotic suffering and leave us with just ordinary suffering. So that's a lot, but it's only the first noble truth of Buddhism, that there's suffering. And so the goal of psychology classically is to deal with that level of suffering, the optional level of suffering, you could say. But spirituality is going to go much further and go all the way and take us from ordinary human unhappiness to extraordinary human happiness. And So there's a way in which the goals are quite different. Psychology goals tend to be more limited and about healing. Spiritual goals are much more about transcendent happiness, liberation. That's pretty clear, right? As a distinction. And I'm sure there could be, you know, a shamanic psychotherapist who would say, no, my goal is, my client's is liberation. So we'll just take that with a grain of salt, too. So there's a difference in goals and, oh, I should check in with time. So that's one difference. The second difference is difference in approaches. So we're working in a psychology way. If we go on retreat and we come up with a trauma memory and it's too much for us to hold on retreat, and this has happened to me, then I needed some other approaches at times, you know, to actually back away from just open, because I was getting overwhelmed and flooded with terrifying memories that my mindfulness just couldn't hold. So then it was really time for me to switch approaches and not just open, but actually do some things that helped me move through the terror and helped me like have some of my fight and flight responses, which is our normal animalistic urges in dealing with trauma, and having those responses and being in relationship with a therapist and working with that, you know, has really helped my nervous system discharge this energy. Now, I could have very well just sat and worked with all of that on retreat and have that all get dissipated through mindfulness. But there's just times when that's, mindfulness is not enough. You need some other approaches. So sometimes you really need to change the content and work with the content and figure another way through. So there's 1,000 approaches to psychotherapy and psychology. So, but just basically, when you're messing with content and you're wanting to change your experience in some way, that's more of a psychological approach. And I'm saying small p. I mean, we can't make hard and fast distinctions. But this is very helpful in your practice to get in touch with. There are times when you're really psyched to keep opening and just being with and just knowing, okay, well, what is depression like or what is fear like? And there are times when that's not at all the right thing for you. And it's really this simple. If you can be mindful of your experience and not get swept away with it, then that I would recommend that. If that's not working for you, and you know, give it a good try. Don't just check in once and like, nope, can't do it. You know, really do your best to be with it. And then if that isn't working for you, you need a different approach. And then this is a whole realm and skill of Western psychology where we have lots of ways of helping you deal with your stresses and your challenges and your tough moods, etc. So different goals and different ways of working. Healing versus liberation. Changing the content versus changing the relationship to the content. So those are the two basic differences as we go here. So let me stop with that and just see if there's any input, questions, or comments at this point. Yes?
I was just wondering, how does transpersonal psychology
So the question is about transpersonal psychology. How does it bridge the gap between messing with content and changing? Transpersonal psychology is a vast field. It's basically anything that integrates the psychological and spiritual. So there's the shamanic side, there's the hypnosis side, which some people feels very spiritual. There's, you know, a Buddhist side, a Christian side. I mean, there's so many ways of doing this, so I don't think I can answer that. But, you know, I very clearly, what we do in the Buddhist tradition, you know, is just what I said. You're either with the experience in mindfulness, and then that's not changing anything. That's only changing the relationship. Now, Buddhism also has its ways of changing the content. So there's a whole series of antidote practices. If you feel like there's anger is just too much part of your system and it's not working, then you practice a lot of loving kindness meditation. This is more like for monks and nuns. But if you're if you're just feeling like racked with desire, then you contemplate peeling that little veneer of skin off the human body and peering inside the human body at all the phlegm and pus and blood and stuff, and that really helps your lust reduce. So, but these are Buddhist ways of changing the, actually changing the content, in a sense by changing the channel. So, that's a kind of Buddhist thing. I don't think. There's many different ways of doing this in other approaches to transpersonal. So does that help?
I'm just wondering how a transpersonal psych, if you were working with or being counseled by a transpersonal psychologist, how they would be working with you on both of those levels, like working on awareness versus making that decision with you about which way to.
Yeah, I mean, if I was, say, in session with a client, do you want to name any challenge, and I could say something?
Well, I mean, you were talking about with depression.
Right. So I would help them in both ways. Because depression is an avoidance. It's actually a shutting down. It's very different from sadness or grief. Sadness and grief are alive, active kind of experiences. Depression is not so much an emotion as a strategy. Shut it down. So. One way of working with that is to open directly towards the depressed state itself, which is the opposite of avoidance. It's confronting. It's being with. So that's one way we work, and we could say that's transpersonal. We're not going to try to change it. We're just being with. But I would also work very much with the person on, what's going on in your life? Is this situational? Is this developmental? Is this coming from childhood wounding? Or is this coming from, what's going on in your life? So that would be, I would do both things. So both and, all of the above. We need it all. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, what psychology does, it'll say, someone's depressed. But what we do in this awareness world is we're like, well, what does that actually mean? So I would have a person track their day. When are you depressed? How much are you depressed? What are the patterns of it? There's actually some real happiness happening too. I mean, when you take a very conceptual approach, it rigidifies things and locks things in. I mean, we're all depressed. We all are going in and out of depressed moods at some point in our lives. But it's so easy to slap these capital D depression or capital T trauma or capital A anxiety labels and not really get into the guts of the experience. And the more this mindfulness approach is coming into psychology, the more people are getting it that all of these problems are just continuums. We're all traumatized to some extent, or depressed to some extent, or anxious to some extent. We all have this. And that's a huge part of the therapy with depression, is for people to get real and not tell themselves stories about, I'm so depressed, but really no, this is actually what my day is like. And for some people it is. Yeah, they're just truly depressed all day long. But that's just another little wrinkle.
lot of complexity. I mean, I don't know, the longer I stand in both of these arenas, the less I can remember what came from where. But, you know, I think even some of what you're describing in transpersonal psychology, I mean, I have from decades ago, from even some of my more classical, you know, training. And it's interesting because I think a lot when I work with folks is there's a real blending of like sitting with people, like how do you sit with what's unchangeable? So I think that balance really is important. It's like being with the understanding and helping people understand their experience and that the place of agency is really in how they meet their experience. I think about my clients who struggle with like chronic pain, and it's like, well, there's pain in the body, but pain's the construct, and so what does that really mean? And often it's the fear and the story that comes with the pain that, you know, and so as you were talking about sort of the, you know, for its statement, it reminded me of the, you know, the two darts in the teaching, and it's like pulling out the second dart and just getting to the pain instead of the fear and story and panic about the pain. And that's easier to sit with.
See how psychological Buddhism is? I mean, that that two darts, you know, story about there's the unavoidable pain and the optional suffering in response, the reaction. And in a psychotherapist working with a client or any of us working with our own minds, if we get this in our minds, there's the unavoidable stuff, just the pain of life, and then there's our contribution. It's massive for people to, I mean, it's optimum mental health to make this distinction, to get that if you can do something, no problem. If you can't do something, also no problem. You know, it's powerful to get this. So, you know, like you say, it's just all,
yeah.
It's a continuum. Okay, so break time, and let's see some announcements. There's a bunch of retreats that I'm doing that I have up on the table. The most near one is the a weekend retreat on learning to embrace change, the crux of Buddhist practice. If you don't like change, want to get better at working with change, then this weekend's for you. And it's all about how our, when we learn it about this work with our changing bodies and minds, we can really deal with our changing lives much better. We get much less attached. So that's that weekend, and I'm doing a nature-based week at the end of May at Vallecitos down in New Mexico, which is a chance to stay in a comfortable little cabin in the woods in the middle of a big wilderness and do a lot of formal practice and a lot of nature-based outdoor practice. That's the last week of May, and then I'm doing with Johan Robbins a canoe, 10-day canoe retreat in the canyon country of western Colorado on the Colorado River. It's a fantastic experience to be in a silent community canoeing down a river and meditating. It's cool. So that's over there too. And Jean, do you want to say anything about your yoga? Or your MBSR class is full. Yeah, I think that's yoga I put over there.
Yeah, yoga. So I know at times people have asked about teaching yoga, and I'm teaching publicly again in Louisville a mindful yoga class. And so a lot of how I teach is
So just to say a little bit, as we go forward, I'm going to focus a little bit on the confusion around the word attachment and the word ego, and talk a little bit about psychological healing and spiritual transformation, and then how the two come together. And then we can leave at midnight. So in the psychology context, ego is very positive. Now, being egotistical is different, but ego, having a healthy ego, is a hallmark of mental health. So positive self-esteem, the ability to meet life as an adventure, the ability to open yourself up to learning new things, this is all ego function and really healthy. And ego, in classical psychoanalytic terms, ego is the reality mediator. And you see if you think you have these parts in you. This is Freud's very simple depiction of the psyche. Our psyche has three basic parts: the id, the ego, and the superego. And maybe many of you know this, but just barely. So the id is our sort of primitive, primal urges. We don't, give a shit what other people think. We're just going to do it our way, And then the superego is sort of some attempt to deal with that and overcompensate by being really punitive and harsh with us. And the ego is this beleaguered part of us in the middle that is actually assessing inner and outer reality and plotting skillful action. And that's super healthy and important. So in the psychological realm, it's all about healthy ego. And now in the Buddhist world, you talk about ego and it's just completely, it's like the opposite. It's everything bad about your psyche. It's the egotism. It's the self-centered part. There's that on the course level, but ego is pretty much anything that obstructs you from spiritual freedom. And I like to make it very simple because a lot of times on the spiritual path we're trying to get rid of our ego because the goal is egolessness. But trying to get rid of ego is more ego. It's oxymoronic. It's the snake eating its tail. It can't work. So what do we do? How do we walk the path? How do we let go of our obstruction to freedom? It's so easy. All we have to do is wake up and notice what mind state we're in. There's no such thing as an ego from the spiritual perspective. There's really just the mind unfolding and the knowing of the mind. But because we use this word a lot in the Buddhist world, I think you could really, the simplest way to think about ego is just lack of awareness. Because awareness, the path is the goal. Awareness is the goal and awareness is the path. And ego is just whatever gets in the way of path, of freedom. And it's always losing awareness. So it's really that simple from the spiritual side. If you're not aware of your experience, you're in some kind of egoic state. That's not the same thing as an egotistical state. You might be not self-centered and being generous to somebody, but really not aware of what you're doing. And even though the generosity is great and wholesome and helpful, to be lost in your experience is an obstruction. So that's just as trying to make it as simple as I possibly can. So don't, if you make ego a thing and a problem, it's just one more way to beat yourself up. Ego isn't the problem. Suffering is the problem. And what makes us suffer is being unaware, ultimately. So, big deal. We all get unaware all the time. We just start over and connect with this moment. As I always say, any reaction is just more distraction, just more ego. So you can get rid of ego. You cannot get rid of ego. You can only wake up in this moment. And so much of ego is healthy. So attachment. Of course, the cause of suffering is what? What in the Buddhist view? What's the cause of suffering?
Craving.
Yeah. Attachment. Right? And they're just synonyms. It's arguing with reality. That's the cause of our suffering, and that's another definition of craving or attachment. Now, in the psychological world, everyone's talking about healthy attachment and how most of our psychological challenges are coming from unhealthy attachment. If we had healthy attachment as children, and very few of us had really, truly, truly healthy attachment, we would be walking around pretty darn happy most of the time. And we're all talking about healthy attachment and how important it is. And I remember on retreat, you know, a couple different times talking to my Buddhist teachers, and I'm coming from a very psychological place, and I'm saying, you know, I was once talking to Joseph at the start of a 6-week retreat, like what practice did I want to do? And I said, you know, some part of me really wants to do Vipassana, but when I really sat with it, you know, what I really want is to do loving kindness practice. And Joseph, now he knows me very well, and he knows how much I was going back and forth. So he really decided he was going to cut right through it. So as soon as I was done saying, I think my heart's desire is just to do metta, Joseph said, who cares? I'm like, what? He's like, we all need these practices many times, metta, vipassana, we all need. And, you know, he was helping me. My initial decision in that retreat was to go with vipassana, but a week in I was saying this, and because I was still sort of deciding how to practice, Joseph was kind of guiding me to just stick with your initial decision. And I did. But I said something like, yeah, but it's what I really want. He's like, on the Buddhist path, what you want is not very important. And I completely disagreed with him on some level, because it's very, very therapeutic, very healing to get in touch with what you deeply, deeply desire. And you could say, in a way, getting parented well is having your parents. Now, I'm not going to say meet your every desire. Don't mean that. But it's to really get what we really want and help us have it and help us celebrate the goodness and, you know, that we can desire things and it's healthy and cool that we can desire something and go for it and get it. And all of this is on the psychological level. It's so different from what we hear as Buddhist practitioners. If you've been deprived of your desires as a child, then that's going to be some kind of attachment wound. And it's going to be very healing for you to go back and feel the desire for what you didn't get and celebrate wanting it and give it to yourself. So when we come to, you know, working psychologically with our minds and changing the content, one of the key things to do is to go back and want what we want and dig into our desire. So just another way in which words are used wildly different in the different approaches is the word abandonment. So healthy attachment comes from not being abandoned and not being engulfed. So most people have both or one or the other. We have fear of being engulfed or we have fear of being abandoned. Because we were, parenting was too much. It was a person sort of coming into our space to meet their needs and not giving us what we wanted. Or it wasn't enough. It was like a person being really removed. And so we are often carrying around both engulfment and abandonment issues, but often leaning towards one or the other. So these are, you know, wounds. It's wounding to be abandoned when you're young, and then that perpetuates in our adult life if we're not conscious. But I like to think of abandonment in a really different way on the spiritual side of things. It is a deep abandonment of yourself to be lost and not aware of your experience. You may have had this experience that when you woke up and realized the nightmare you were having was just a movie in your mind. And really it's a story, not to trivialize it, because if it's deep and big, there's something important information in it. But when you wake up and realize, oh, I'm sitting here and I'm spinning these wild thoughts and images, and there's a breath and there's sound and there's birds, you realize you were abandoned. You were lost, completely lost in this thought world, and you didn't realize the only reason you were suffering is because you were lost in a thought world. And boom, you wake up from the dream. Thank God, it was just a dream. I was just really spinning some wild stories. So it's a completely different sense of the term abandonment. You know, we're abandoning ourselves a lot when we're not present and aware with our experience. We lose our freedom in the moment when we're not aware of our experience. We are lost in the movie. Now, we can wake up to the movie and choose to act on the movie, knowing it's a movie. That's a whole nother thing. But if we don't know it's a movie, it's going to run us. If we know it's happening, then we get to decide. Otherwise, the movie decides. So this is a spiritual abandonment. And we all do it all day long. We get lost, we come back. We get lost, we come back. So, okay. I don't know how to do all the rest of this. This is a big chunk. The next step is to talk about how we heal psychologically, and then after that, how we liberate spiritually, and then how we integrate. That's all. There's two basic things that psychology helps us with healing, and helps us heal our developmental challenges. So the ways in which our childhood wounding is impacting our present life. If it's not, great. But most people find that if they're struggling in relationships, there's some childhood stuff getting in the way. And their partner's reminding them of mom or dad or something like it. And a person, rather than relating to their partner as they are, they're relating to them through some kind of filter that unconsciously is all about mom and dad and what happened to you as a child. So that's one big part of psychological healing. Another big part is working with trauma, actual event-based trauma where, you know, bad stuff happened to us that wasn't just the overall family system we were in, but is really like, you know, there was you know, I mean, sometimes it's a bike accident, sometimes, God forbid, it's sexual abuse, or a car accident, or natural disaster. And that's just a whole realm of psychology that our mindfulness can do some stuff with, but it's much better, much faster to work on it in psychotherapy, both the developmental wounding and the trauma wounding. You know, years, decades of retreat can leave this stuff untouched. And I guess maybe you could say a third realm that mindfulness can leave untouched, but it can really help, is our relationship struggles. That if our relationships show us sometimes both our developmental and our event trauma. And so these are three basic arenas. Maybe that was enough. What people don't understand who are only doing spiritual practice is the tremendous power that gets recovered when you go back and heal your childhood wounds, heal your developmental wounds. It brings you back to we could call it a core in our hearts where we feel powerful, we feel lovable, we feel capable of loving, and we're sort of in love with life. And I mean, just in my own psychological work, meditation didn't touch that at first. Meditation did a lot for me, but it wasn't until I went back and looked at some of my childhood wounding that I started to actually integrate all parts of me with my spiritual yearning. So, I'm just going to stop for a little bit and just see if there's any input.
Following up on your talk last week, where you talked about relative reality and ultimate reality, I wonder if perhaps psychology is dealing with relative reality and spirituality is dealing with ultimate reality.
Beautiful. Yay! And again, it's not even, it's really mostly the goal, because you can do tremendous healing in service of liberation. And the relative leading to the absolute, to the ultimate. You know, again, this used to be bigger dichotomies than maybe it is for you, but there was this sort of clear-cut thing, oh, well, that's, you know, you're getting involved with the content. That's, you know, that's some other thing. You know, just be mindful. And now I think the more I've practiced, the more you deal with the content and heal yourself, the more open you are to liberation and freedom. And it makes you more present to have dealt with your developmental and trauma wounds. So it's really a both and. The psychological healing is a powerful platform for your liberation. So now we're talking about integrating, but okay.
Yeah, I think it's a little long. What I was going to ask, don't you think it's a different feel to the whole thing where psychology, maybe you're going to look for the problems, and you know, we can dig up bad stuff forever. Mm-hmm. But if you go on the spiritual path, you sort of get a glimpse of you're not this content, and it could be a refuge that I'm not this content. And then later when you touch on that content, it might be really bad. And you might have to go back to your refuge. But at least you realize, oh, I really am okay. There is some content here, okay. It seems like a different ways of getting at this thing.
Yes. I mean, I would agree that if you, the more open you are spiritually, in a way, the more psychological healing is possible. And then the more you heal psychologically, the more you're open to spiritual. So, yeah, it's both directions.
Feels like, you know, when I think about the two arenas that, you know, one of the, I think, very common strategies for navigating the developmental and the traumatic is to shut down and to tune out. And since mindfulness is so much about waking up and tuning in, it's like it does build a platform to really open up when your nervous system is not in that survival mode, you know. So it does feel like it can go both ways, depending on the intensity, perhaps, of, you know, what somebody's carrying.
I don't think I need to say too much about how we transform on the spiritual path, because I've already said so much about that, so you've heard me. You're just going to hear me repeat a bunch of stuff. So we'll go right into integrating, and then we'll do some practice. So there's the old adage, in terms of how to integrate the healing and the liberating, the psychological and the spiritual. You have to be a somebody before you can be a nobody. That was Jack Engler who said that. So that we need actually a healthy ego strength before we can really open deeply to no self. And in my experience, there's a lot of truth to that. Deep openings to no self can feel shattering at times. Now, it depends on your path. For some people who are doing it all at once, it can be like that. For many, it's more gradual and doesn't feel that. But the more you're really healthy and feeling good about yourself and competent in the world and competent, you know, and you like your identity and all those ego pieces, the more you can open and keep opening when it gets really weird. And it can get really weird where you don't know who you are and your thoughts, who's doing these thoughts and where are they coming from. And it's wildly out of your control. It can be scary. And so there's a way in which, you know, being psychologically together is very helpful for awakening. But I have another little saying about this is, so psychological healing in many ways is about going back and owning what you repressed, because we had to survive. So the psychological move is to own what you disowned, and then the spiritual move is to disown what you've owned. So you could sum it up that simply: own what you disown and disown what you owned. But you have to own it first before you can disown it. And that's just another little simple integration bumper sticker, and no one would know what I meant, but except us. So that's a kind of general thing, but it's not that clean cut. You can still have powerful openings and still have a lot of psychological work to do. And for me, it's been a path of healing and liberating all my life. So I've been working on changing the content and changing my relationship to it. It's great to have both. You know, we do what we can do, and we let go. So, it's not necessarily you have to be somebody before you can be a nobody. You have nobody experiences, and you go back to your somebody self, you know. But they are different. They're just different approaches. And sometimes you need more of one, and sometimes you need more of the other. Sometimes you need to emphasize the healthy ego more and figure out who the somebody you are. And sometimes you want to lean much more towards the nobody. And then the last little point to address is spiritual bypass. So when we integrate. And this is really well known now as a phenomenon. But in the 70s, you know, and Daniel Goleman talks about this, the psychologist, that he spent most of the 70s meditating in his basement and ignoring his wife and ended up getting divorced. He was down there doing a lot of spiritual practice in the basement level, but on the upstairs level, it was all a big bypass. And so as non-monastics, we want to be really careful about not having our spiritual life trump our relative life. Again, building on last week, that the ultimate transcends and includes the relative. We get better at the relative when we're more open spiritually. If we're really contacting, you know, more the ultimate side of things, we take care of our lives much better. So if your life is going down, I think it's Jack Kornfield who says, we have to know both our Buddha nature and our zip code. You know, both things are important. So now spiritual bypass is pretty well known about. If you're using it to avoid your work responsibilities in your relationship and your life's going to hell, look into it. You don't hear many people talking about psychological bypass. So what do you guess that is? What's a psychological bypass? Say it again.
Hiding out in the spiritual.
Well, that's what spiritual bypass. Spiritual bypass is hiding out in the spiritual. So if that's what spiritual bypass, then what is psychological bypass? That, and in addition, thinking that all you are is your problems. Mm-hmm. We are not our problems. We are Buddha nature. We aren't our zip codes and all the problems in those zip codes. Our problems come and go, but our Buddha nature, our basic goodness, our ability to be aware and loving is who we really are. In a no-self way. And, you know, if you're in the psychological world in any way, it's so easy to only focus on the problems and forget your deeper nature and your spiritual potential. So this is the other integration piece. It's not to err on the spiritual bypass and also to really only focus on the problems when you need to focus on a problem. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know? Or if it's broken, it doesn't matter, don't fix it. Life is short, you know? And we can be, you know, we don't get a personality transplant. We can be imperfect in our perfection, in our awakening. So don't think you have to solve every little neurosis. Ram Dass said, after all these years of spiritual practice, I haven't lost a single neurosis. 40 years or something. But what's changed, I don't know his exact words, but what's really changed is his relationship. There's huge amount of space around those neuroses. It's not so much that we lose our patterns, they just become a much smaller part of our mind. Our psyche gets much larger. So, okay, we'll end with just a little practice. And as much as you're able, just let go of the words. and see if you can be as impeccably present with your experience as is possible right now.